Hello, I'm Father Ray Petrucci. Welcome to Thoughts for the Week. We're going to have a fascinating program. I hope you'll be able to devote the next half hour to our show. Before beginning with our introductions, I thought I would perhaps invite you, our listeners, to consider giving us a little information yourself. Not personal, of course, simply your ideas. Maybe you have some recommendations or some thoughts on topics that we could provide for you. We're happy to do that. If you wish to write us, just put a stamp on a letter, you could send it to Thoughts for the Week, Post Office Box 7466. That's Post Office Box 7466, Greenwich, Connecticut. The zip code in Greenwich is 06836. That's 06836. If you prefer emailing us, you can do that at the following address, clemons10@aol.com. That's C-L-E-M-O-N-S, the number 10, at AOL.com. And while you're on the computer, please go to our internet magazine, Spirituality for Today. You can find that at this website, spirituality.org. That's spirituality.org. Also, you can listen to our program, Thoughts for the Week, which are available there at that site, and therefore you can hear at your leisure. Well, my next duty is to welcome my wonderful co-host, Ms. Dorothy Riera. Welcome.
Thank you, Father. Always happy to be here with you.
And delighted to have you with me and our guest. We are happy to welcome Suzanne Deschain, I believe.
Yes.
Very good. And Suzanne has been here way in the past, I believe. And she is an associate professor of biology here at Sacred Heart University. Did I get that correctly, or are there other things?
Absolutely. You've got it right.
Oh, I'm so happy. Great to begin the show. Something great. But we have a wonderful topic regarding faith and science. Interesting area, interesting combination, of course. Having a professor here of biology, of the scientific disciplines, as well as a wonderful woman of faith, just combines it perfectly. But let me welcome you and maybe give a little bit of background of yourself and how you ended up here at Sacred Heart.
Well, that's a long journey, but starting way back when I was a little child, I always was in love with things of nature. I would turn over stones, I would fish and get frogs, and as I went through high school, it became clear that biology was the place for me. So I went on to college, and I studied biology there, and had some wonderful mentors who guided me along the way, and I fell in love with research as part of that process. So I went on to University of Pennsylvania, earned my PhD in a field called cell and molecular biology. Mm-hmm. However, most of the work that I did had a lot of genetics in it. So we actually mapped or looked for a gene that was responsible for an immune deficiency. So some people may have heard of David the Bubble Boy. So this was a child who grew up in a bubble because he had no immune system. So we were one of the groups that found that gene, and we used dogs to find the gene as well because they also have the same disease. So after that, I went on, I graduated, and what do I do next? And cancer was a big attraction for me, so I decided to go into a cancer genetics lab and studied how mutations in a certain or changes in a certain series of genes that protect us from environmental damage, how if you interrupt those genes and you make them not function well, you can then get more mutations developing in your body, and that leads to cancer like colorectal cancer. So I did that for several years, and it was time to move on, and this teaching bug had been bugging me ever since college, and I decided to try out Sacred Heart for a year, and it worked out. I'm here now 16 years later. On the, you know, tenured and quite happy working with students, mentoring them and teaching them about genetics and my joy for it.
Well, we're delighted to have you joining us today with this topic and such a wonderful background. And perhaps we might begin to taking a look at what, you know, the area of science and the area of faith and how you feel they kind of apply to one another.
That is an excellent question. And for many years, I kept them in separate boxes. It was much easier to keep faith in one end, and I would go to church on the weekends, and I would study some of the documents now and then, go to, you know, young adult groups, and then I would go to work, and I would do my science there. But that was not satisfactory. So for many years, I struggled with that connection between the two. And at some point, it came to me that there is no discrepancy between the two. They should not be kept in separate boxes, that faith and reason and faith and science go together. And there was a beautiful marriage of those two that occurred in my brain at the time, and it was an epiphany. And it's an integrative way of seeing the world, right? It's a more healthy way to try to bring together all the various facets of your life. And so faith and reason have been commented on by many people before us, and John Paul II was one of them. He convened a conference of scientists in 1987, and as a result of that, there was a publication of some of the scientific talks that were given, and what was interesting is that he responded to what he saw, and he made a beautiful statement about how science and faith are not incompatible. He made statements in the past about evolution and faith not being incompatible, but now he went further and he went into the science, how it's needed, how it can inform our religious tradition, and how our religious tradition can inform the science. So you can't have one divorced from the other. The two have to work together in order to better understand their own disciplines, in order to better understand how to serve humanity and this planet that we're on.
Well, I think Thomas Aquinas is a beautiful example of reason and faith. Because even though he is a Catholic theologian, he has always studied no matter where, in what university,
absolutely,
under the philosophy courses. Mm-hmm. He is a must. So there's no doubt that he was able to bring them together.
Oh, absolutely. In a beautiful way, too.
Yes.
Yeah, certainly in studying Western civilization, you certainly find so much of the scientific contributions coming from the religious monasteries in so many, many different ways. And I always saw that, you know, science really, I mean, part of God's gift to the human, part of God's presence is that curiosity, that inquiry, that desire to learn, to know, whether it's in a scientific discipline or whether it's prose, poetry, whatever it may be, the arts, whatever it may be. But you began to mention something that I know is a really, really developing area and an emerging area, and that area of genetics.
Mm-hmm.
You talked a lot about that, and mm-hmm. talk about God's creative powers.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we certainly find so much in that. I guess I'm asking a definition of a gene, definition of genetics. You certainly are the right person to ask. And our listeners may really, you know, want to know this.
Well, so who coined the term, or who is known as the father of genetics? This is an Augustinian friar by the name of Gregor Mendel, and he published his first findings of these things we call genes today. He didn't call it a gene back then, but that's what he discovered in his peas. So in the mid-1800s, he published this wonderful paper, and it was underappreciated. Nobody appreciated the genius that he saw. And at the same time, Darwin published his work as well on evolution and genetics at a population level. But he didn't understand Mendel's work. He probably didn't know Mendel existed, and vice versa. And so it was only in the 20th century that we put all this together. Mm-hmm. So genetics is now known as the field of the study of heredity, and how characteristics vary between individuals. So we're looking at individuals like plants. We're looking at insects, animals, humans, the whole, you know, panoply of life. So that's genetics. And gene is the smallest unit of inheritance. So a gene is like a blueprint or an instruction for a protein or something that has a function in the cell. So basically that gene is composed of a chemical called DNA. So genes are the smallest units of inheritance. They're made of DNA. Where do we find them in our bodies? Where do we find genes? They're located on these long, stringy bits of DNA called chromosomes. So genes dot there are thousands and thousands of genes on our chromosomes, and we pass on half of these chromosomes to our children. And our spouse gives the other half of their chromosomes. And those genes are then carried on those chromosomes into the egg and then eventually into the new embryo. So genes are basically, think of them as sentences in a chapter. The chapter would be your chromosome. And you have multiple chapters in a book. The book would be all the DNA that is found in the nucleus, or the DNA that makes up who we are. So we call that the genome. So a gene is a sentence. It's something meaningful. It means something. It's found on a chromosome, which is like a paragraph or a chapter in a book. And you put all the chapters together, all the chromosomes together, and they make up what we call the genome, which carries all of the information for making who we, for making us who we are.
Is there a way, we know that there are defective genes, are
yes.
there not?
Yes.
Is there a way in modern science to correct defective genes today?
Yes, absolutely. So first let's define what we mean by a defective gene. So we all have genes, and they come in various varieties. Some of us have, let's say a gene is named A. You might have the version A1. Somebody else may have A2. Sometimes you have two versions because mom gave you A1 and dad gave you A2. These are neutral changes. They don't do anything to your body. But once in a while, a change occurs in the sequence of that gene, the information, the instructions of that gene, and that change in the sequence changes the function of that protein that's encoded by the gene. So the function now either is less than it was, or it's completely gone, or it could be worse. So these changes can lead to disease.
Mm-hmm.
So now the question is, how can we remove those negative changes and replace them with the appropriate sequence? So this is where we get into gene therapy. And gene therapy, there are two kinds. The kind that you can do, let's say, in you if you're sick, or the kind that we can do in your embryos should you decide to reproduce. You have embryos. If we make the changes there, we're making changes that affect future generations. So we call that reproductive gene therapy, whereas the kind of gene therapy you would do on you to correct your disease would be something like somatic gene therapy. So we've been dealing with somatic for a long time, at least 20, 30 years. There have been some problems with gene therapy.
Mm-hmm.
So we use viruses to introduce correct DNA, correct genes, to correct the defect. Unfortunately, if those viruses put the DNA in the wrong place in your genome, remember the chapter of information in your cells, if that DNA goes in the wrong place, you can interrupt another gene that's important for your normal development. So here's what happened. One study looked at children who had a type of immune deficiency.
Mm-hmm.
They corrected their defect with viral gene therapy. The children were quite normal again. And several years later, two out of the three children developed a leukemia.
Mm.
When they went to look, why did this come up? It turns out that the gene they inserted with the virus went into some key genes that control our cells' growth. These genes now weren't working as they should, and there was overgrowth of blood cells, and they had leukemia. So that's only one of a number of problems we had with viral gene therapy. However, there have been successes as well. We have viral gene therapy that's been successfully used for treating melanoma, and there are other instances. So that's...
So is it the cause of, let's, you mentioned leukemia, is a problem in the gene?
Correct.
There is a genetic
defect,
yep. And that is what produces the leukemia in children or adults or whoever.
Whatever the disease is, correct.
Mm-hmm.
So now here's where it gets a little more interesting. So we now have a new technique called CRISPR. It's an acronym for a much longer name. And it's a way of very specifically removing the genetic defect and replacing it with the correct sequence. Now, why do I bring this up? Because it turns out we've been using this new technique for the last 10 years. It's been and it's been hot for the last 5. Very, very, very easy to change sequences. However, there's always a however.
Mm-hmm.
But there are side effects. This system has not always been faithful in making its changes, and it introduces what we call off-target mutations. So it not only changes what you want, it changes other sequences, which could bring up problems. And they've been working hard to make enhancements to this system to make it work better. So we have now been able to modify patients' immune cells using this technique so that they're more active, they're more able to recognize cancer, and you put those immune cells back into the patient who has cancer, and they've been able to cure leukemia in many patients in the first study that just came out in the last year or so. So this technique has been already showing much fruit in terms of therapy of people, a type of gene therapy that does not require viruses. And it's very specific. But the question is, what will happen over the long run with these people? Will they develop secondary cancers? But see, they've gained life now. They've gained many more years of life than they would have otherwise. It's no different than chemotherapy, you know. Here's where it gets more crazy. We are now playing for the last couple of years with editing human embryos using this technique. Hmm. And just last week, published in the journal Nature, was a study out of Oregon Health and Sciences University. I did my postdoc over there, and they just reported they were able to eliminate a cardiac defective gene. So a cardiac disease gene was removed from human embryos successfully and replaced with the correct one with no side effects, no off-target mutations. So this is exciting in some ways, and it's also concerning, right?
Of course.
We're working with human embryos. And what happened to these human embryos, they did not implant them in a woman's womb. Mm-hmm. They studied them, and in the process of studying them, they destroyed some of them, and the rest were discarded or used for additional research. So what is also unknown is, yes, we don't have any instance of off-target mutations that we know of, but there could be other problems that we don't yet appreciate. Mm-hmm. So scientists are urging caution, much caution, as we move forward. We should move forward is what scientists are saying, but we should be very careful.
But to be honest, these are very specific tests that are done at very specific universities and very specific. It's not like every hospital can do anything.
No, of course not. Yeah. It requires a lot of technical expertise, and even the experts say that it doesn't work very well. That's why we need to continue doing this work. Mm-hmm. As Catholic Christians, this raises a lot of thorny issues.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me bring it to do they maybe hope to foresee being able to correct a problem, let's say with a pregnant woman, and you discovered that there is something, you know, the child may have a heart defect or some other illness. Is that way down the road being able to say, well, listen, maybe we might be able to do something?
For this particular defect, once the woman knows she's pregnant, it's already too late because the child has developed far enough. The heart has already started developing. There are many cells.
Everything's in action.
Exactly. And we're talking here approaches that involve a single cell.
Mm-hmm.
And the heart has many thousands of cells and millions of cells by the point that you would even be able to appreciate, one, the pregnancy, and two, be able to intervene. And it's very tricky surgery. You put the fetus at risk and the mother.
And the mother.
Exactly. So when it's too far advanced, it becomes very hard to treat, and unfortunately we saw that with little Charlie Gard in England, who died recently. He had a very rare mitochondrial defect. Mitochondria are the powerhouses of our cell, and they also contain some DNA, and if those don't work right, you can get a whole host of rather problematic diseases, including his. And by the time that they were able to consider a possible treatment, which was not even going to guarantee, it wasn't going to reverse his condition at all. It was going to return some functionality, minimal, and it was never even tested on his particular disorder. Mm-hmm. It had been tested in other mitochondrial disorders. So by the time they were able to consider that, it was already too late. This child had really, really progressed to the point where he could not survive on his own.
Mm-hmm. These genetic defects, how do they come about? Is it through nature? Is it through food? Is it through the environment? Is there anything that determines how a mother or a father transmit this genetic imperfection?
Oh, these are excellent questions. Imagine the parent who passes on a genetic defect, how they feel guilty, but mm-hmm. It's not in their control mm-hmm. most of the time. So, for example, if you have a disease like muscular dystrophy, the kind that most children get is the type where only boys get it. And they get that on their X chromosome, which is passed down to them from mom. So mom is the one who's responsible for passing down that disorder. She herself doesn't have it, but she passed it on to her boys. So in that case, you can blame heredity. You can blame just the fact that that mutation already existed. But how did that mutation arise in the first place? Mm-hmm. And biology has shown us time and time again that the machinery for replicating the DNA, the genetic material in our cells, is very, very faithful, and there are all kinds of repair mechanisms in place to prevent mutation, and mm-hmm. we have a wonderful system. However, it does make mistakes mm-hmm. once in a great while, mm-hmm. and those mistakes are not caught, and it produces mutation. So this is what we call random mutation, mm-hmm. and it's under nobody's control. It's mm-hmm. just simply a fact of biology of nature. However, we can expose ourselves to nasty environmental agents. Mm-hmm. Smoking mm-hmm. is known to cause mutations, mm-hmm. and many people who smoke develop some form of lung cancer. Not everyone, but many people do. So the kinds of things we expose ourselves to in our food, in our air, in our water, anything in the environment, our mothers, what they ate, and what they were exposed to, breathing, drinking, mm-hmm. when they were pregnant. Now, this brings up a different type of mutation, not a mutation, a different type of effect on our bodies. So when we say that we have DNA in us, and we say that it controls who we are and it determines who we are, that's not the whole truth. So I can have identical twins, and one of them develops cancer and not the other. Mm-hmm. So why is that? Because of some environmental change. And they can change when the genes turn on or off. So changes in the environment can have an effect on our bodies. So, for example, there is a case in World War II where the Scandinavian countries were experiencing famine. And people that were pregnant at that time were not receiving adequate nutrition. And what you see is in two generations, three generations later, those children have a higher incidence of metabolic disorders like diabetes, mm-hmm. obesity, cardiovascular disease. Where does it come from? It's traced back several generations to someone who was exposed to bad environmental mm-hmm. conditions. So that's not a mutation. That's simply the environment affecting your genes, whether they get turned on or off, and those changes are stable enough to pass down to your kids. So I often tell my students, you be careful what you do to your body now. You think that it's not going to affect your future children. It could very well. It can make changes in your eggs and your sperm, and even what you ate the day before you conceive, has been shown in mice to affect wow. the children. Sure, wow. sure. A high-fat diet, drugs. That in animal studies we're seeing changes that affect the next generations. That's very sobering, isn't it?
It certainly is. Which brings us, I think, not only to genes, but also this program rapidly is reaching its conclusion. Inherited, exactly how much do we inherit? Do we inherit directly from parents or from grandparents or from the entire history of our
all of the above.
Okay.
All of the above. So first of all, we inherit half of our DNA from each parent, and they inherit half of their DNA from each of their parents. Mm-hmm. So you're receiving genes from your your grandparents, your great-grandparents, and back, way back. So we're inheriting all of this DNA from ancestors all the way back since we evolved. Mm-hmm. you know.
Now, would you consider that, therefore, a healthy reality for a human being to have a mixture, a wide variety of genetic input, rather than, let's say, those who are of a closed community with a lot of interbreeding type of thing?
So if you are a very uniform society where people all have the same genetic background, the chances of genetic issues and diseases mm-hmm. becomes higher, right? Because they all have very similar genes. I always tell people, if you're going to get a dog, get a mutt, because mm-hmm. the mutt will be a lot healthier than your pure breed, you know? Mm-hmm. So, you know, most of us are mutts at this point in the United States, but there are still some very uniform communities that have very little genetic diversity, and that can cause some problems. But we're not just the... like I said before, our DNA is a big part of that determines who we are. But is that all we inherit, you asked? I think you can now add we inherit the environmental exposures of our ancestors.
Mm, interesting.
That you can add that to your list of inheritance.
What about personality? Do we inherit, or do we even know? You have your father's sense of humor, you got your mother's seriousness, you got...
Well, that's another good question. So when we look at personality, we're looking at a lot of different genes and environment influencing mm-hmm. your personality. So yes, I could have dad's sense of humor, but it is also shaped by the environment that I grew up in. So if I grew up in a bad environment, maybe I won't have such a great sense of humor because mm-hmm. I'll be depressed, you know? Mm-hmm. So it's a combination of what you inherited.
Also, you grew up with your father's sense of humor. You're experiencing the parents and,
yes.
and you're observing all that.
Yes.
What about athletics? Is that more something you might, you know, your father was Michael Jordan?
again, athletic ability is determined by multiple genes, I think. Mm-hmm. There are some genes that give you better aerobic capacity, so you can do you can do more endurance sports than other people. I would bet you Lance Armstrong has some mutations in him that mm-hmm. benefited him. But it's going to be multiple genes. So if we're going to try to make a designer child in the future who's got the X personality and X athletic ability, you're going to have to change multiple genes.
Okay.
Good luck with that.
Incredibly, we only have a couple of minutes left to our program. I want to answer one question about, because from the faith end of it, ethics in the scientific community, because you already alluded to it a couple of times.
It is big. Sometimes the public has the idea that scientists don't think about the ethical implications of their work, that we just move forward and we don't think about all of these repercussions. And we do, actually. We do think very seriously. We engage ethicists, lawyers, the public in what we do. And in fact, in the last couple of years, there have been some meetings to discuss CRISPR, this technology mm-hmm. that was used to edit human embryos, mm-hmm. the discussion of whether we should or should not mm-hmm. edit human embryos, to what extent should we take it, that's all being discussed right now. It's being mm-hmm. discussed in view of the public as well.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so very much ethics is very much thought about.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, it's a great cost. We have so much more to discuss, and we'll have an opportunity, another program to do so. But I'd like to thank our listeners for joining us today, and also Professor Suzanne Duchesne for being with us. And we'd like to and hope that all of you will join us again next week for Thoughts for the Week. God bless everyone. Have a wonderful week.